Before we begin, I want to let you know that this episode is entirely AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing. Today's show is brought to you by Bloomquill, the fictional smart pen that reads your handwriting back to you in 17 different accents. And please remember that some details we discuss might be inaccurate, so do double-check anything important to you. Welcome to Literary Conversations. I'm Sarah. And today we're diving into one of the most controversial and influential novels in English literature. With me is Marcus Chen, professor of 18th century literature at Columbia University and author of several books on early English fiction. Marcus, we're discussing John Cleland's Fanny Hill, published in 1748.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. It's fascinating to tackle this novel because it operates on so many levels simultaneously.
For listeners who might only know Fanny Hill by reputation, let's establish what kind of book this actually is.
Right. It's structured as a memoir, with Fanny writing letters to an unnamed woman, recounting her journey from rural innocence to London courtesan to respectable wife.
And it was immediately banned for obscenity, which raises the question of what Cleland was really trying to accomplish.
Exactly. On the surface, it's erotic literature, but it's also a sharp social commentary and a surprisingly sophisticated psychological portrait.
The novel follows classical narrative patterns while dealing with decidedly unclassical subject matter.
That's what makes it so intriguing. Cleland uses the conventions of moral literature to tell an immoral story, or at least a story about immorality.
Before we go further, should listeners be concerned about major spoilers?
The basic arc is fairly predictable, given the genre conventions of the time. Fanny tells us from the beginning that she ends up married and respectable.
So the interest lies not in where she ends up, but in how she gets there.
Precisely. And in Cleland's distinctive voice and his surprisingly nuanced treatment of sexuality and social class.
Let's talk about that journey. Fanny begins as a 15-year-old orphan leaving the countryside for London.
She's almost immediately deceived and nearly sold into prostitution by Mrs. Brown, who runs what we'd now call a trafficking operation.
But she escapes that fate through a combination of luck and her own agency, which becomes important to how we read her character.
Right. She's not simply a victim of circumstances. Even in vulnerable moments, Fanny maintains a kind of self-possession and curiosity about her experiences.
She then enters Mrs. Cole's establishment, which Cleland presents as a very different sort of place.
Mrs. Cole runs what's essentially a high-end brothel, but Cleland depicts it almost like a finishing school. The women there are educated, articulate, and relatively autonomous.
This is where the novel's treatment of sex work becomes complex and controversial.
Cleland presents prostitution as potentially liberating for women, which is a remarkable position for 1748. Though obviously problematic by today's standards.
The world of the novel is very much London in the mid-18th century, with its rigid class hierarchies and limited options for women.
Exactly. Fanny's choices are essentially marriage to someone she doesn't choose, destitution, or entering the sex trade.
And Cleland uses this constrained world to explore questions about agency, desire, and social mobility.
The London he depicts is both brutal and full of possibility. It's a place where someone like Fanny can reinvent herself, but at considerable cost.
The physical spaces in the novel seem carefully chosen. Mrs. Cole's house, the various bedrooms, even the rural cottage where Fanny is born.
Cleland is very attentive to domestic spaces and how they shape behavior. Mrs. Cole's house is described almost like a theater, with elaborate rooms designed for performance.
Which connects to the novel's concern with performance and authenticity. Is Fanny performing desire or genuinely experiencing it?
That's one of the central tensions. Cleland suggests that performed pleasure can become real pleasure, which was a radical idea.
Let's turn to Fanny herself as a character. What drives her throughout this narrative?
Survival, certainly, but also curiosity. She's genuinely interested in sexual experience and in understanding her own responses.
She's also remarkably articulate about those experiences, which raises questions about Cleland's realistic characterization.
Right. This 15-year-old country girl somehow acquires an extraordinary vocabulary and analytical ability. It's one of the novel's tensions.
But perhaps that's part of the point. Cleland is less interested in strict realism than in creating a voice that can articulate female sexual experience.
Exactly. Fanny becomes a kind of spokesperson for female desire, even if that voice is obviously filtered through a male author's imagination.
Her relationship with Charles, her first lover, seems to establish a template for how she understands sexuality.
Charles represents romantic love combined with sexual pleasure. When he's forced to leave for the South Seas, Fanny is devastated but also liberated to explore.
And she does explore, with a series of partners who each teach her something different.
There's Mr. H, the wealthy keeper, who offers security but little emotional connection. Then Will, the young sailor who represents pure physical attraction.
Each relationship seems designed to explore different aspects of sexuality and power dynamics.
Yes, and Fanny maintains agency in each situation, even when she's technically dependent on male protection.
The other women at Mrs. Cole's also function as important characters. How do they relate to Fanny's development?
They serve as both mentors and cautionary tales. Each has her own story of how she entered the trade and what she hopes to achieve.
Cleland gives them distinct personalities, rather than treating them as interchangeable figures.
Right. There's Louisa, who's more business-minded, and Emily, who's more romantic. They represent different approaches to surviving in their world.
Mrs. Cole herself is a fascinating figure. She's both protective and exploitative.
She represents a kind of alternative social structure. Under her guidance, these women support each other rather than competing destructively.
Which again complicates any simple reading of the novel as either celebrating or condemning prostitution.
Cleland seems more interested in exploring the psychology of these relationships than in making moral judgments.
When Charles finally returns and reunites with Fanny, how has she changed as a character?
She's gained sexual experience and social sophistication, but Cleland suggests she's retained her essential self.
This brings us to one of the novel's central themes. What is Cleland really exploring beneath the explicit content?
I think the primary theme is the relationship between nature and society, particularly regarding female sexuality.
Fanny repeatedly talks about natural impulses versus social conventions.
Right? Cleland seems to argue that sexual desire is natural and that society's attempts to suppress it are artificial and harmful.
But he's also showing how social structures shape and constrain that natural desire.
Exactly. Fanny can't simply follow her nature. She has to navigate a complex social world that often penalizes female desire.
The novel also seems concerned with questions of authenticity. What's genuine versus what's performed?
This comes up repeatedly. Fanny learns to perform desire professionally, but Cleland suggests this doesn't diminish her capacity for genuine feeling.
In fact, the professional performance might enhance her understanding of authentic desire.
That's a sophisticated psychological insight. Experience, even commodified experience, can lead to greater self-knowledge.
There's also a persistent theme about observation and spectatorship.
Fanny is constantly watching others and being watched herself. The novel is full of scenes where characters observe sexual encounters.
This connects to the reader's position as well. We're voyeurs consuming Fanny's story.
Cleland seems aware of this dynamic and uses it to complicate any simple moral reading of the novel.
Class mobility is another recurring concern. Can Fanny actually transcend her origins?
She does, ultimately, but only through marriage to Charles, who has inherited wealth. Her own earnings disappear.
So despite celebrating her agency and independence, the novel ends with traditional domestic arrangements.
This reflects the real constraints of 18th century society. Even Cleland's imagination couldn't envision complete female economic independence.
The theme of education runs throughout as well. What kind of education does Fanny receive?
It's an education in desire, in social navigation, and in self-presentation. Very different from formal education, but equally transformative.
And she becomes the teacher by narrating her experiences to the unnamed correspondent.
Right? The epistolary structure makes Fanny both student and instructor, which gives her considerable authority.
Money appears as a motif throughout. How does Cleland treat the relationship between sexuality and economics?
He's remarkably frank about the economic realities underlying sexual relationships, even romantic ones.
Charles can only marry Fanny after he inherits money. Love requires economic foundation.
And Fanny's time as a courtesan is explicitly about financial survival and advancement. Cleland doesn't romanticize this.
But he also suggests that economic transactions don't necessarily preclude genuine feeling.
This was probably shocking to contemporary readers who preferred clearer distinctions between love and commerce.
Religious themes appear sporadically. How does Cleland handle questions of morality and sin?
He largely sidesteps traditional Christian morality in favor of what we might call natural morality.
Fanny rarely expresses guilt about her sexual experiences, which must have been revolutionary.
Instead, she judges actions based on whether they cause harm or promote genuine pleasure and connection.
This connects to Enlightenment philosophy about natural law versus revealed religion.
Absolutely. Cleland is participating in broader 18th century debates about the sources of moral authority.
Let's discuss Cleland's distinctive style. How does he actually tell this story?
The most striking thing is his elaborate, euphemistic language for describing sexual acts.
He creates an entire vocabulary of metaphors and circumlocutions.
Right? Male anatomy becomes machines or engines. Sexual encounters become conflicts or engagements. It's almost militaristic.
This allows him to be explicit while maintaining a veneer of literary respectability.
But it also creates a distinctive voice. Fanny's elevated diction contrasts sharply with her supposed background.
The epistolary structure gives him other advantages as well.
It allows for intimate confession while maintaining distance. Fanny is writing to someone specific but unknown to us.
And it provides a frame for the narrative that suggests moral instruction.
Exactly. The letter format implies that Fanny is sharing her experiences for the correspondent's benefit.
Cleland's sentence structure tends toward the elaborate and periodic.
He builds long, complex sentences that mirror the building of sexual tension and release. The prose itself becomes erotic.
His descriptions of physical spaces are remarkably detailed.
He understands that setting shapes behavior. The description of Mrs. Cole's drawing room, for instance, emphasizes luxury and sensual comfort.
The pacing varies considerably. Some scenes are drawn out extensively, while others are summarized quickly.
He lingers over moments of sexual discovery and psychological insight, but rushes through transitions and mundane details.
Point of view is crucial here. Everything is filtered through Fanny's consciousness as she remembers it.
This gives Cleland tremendous flexibility. Fanny can be naive in the moment, but analytical in retrospection.
The dialogue, when it appears, tends to be stilted by modern standards.
Characters often speak in the same elevated style as the narration. It's more theatrical than naturalistic.
How does Cleland handle the passage of time in the narrative?
He compresses years into key scenes and moments. We get highlights rather than comprehensive chronology.
This keeps the focus on psychological and sexual development, rather than mundane daily existence.
Right, and it allows him to maintain dramatic intensity throughout the narrative.
Let's place this novel in its historical context. What was Cleland responding to when he wrote it?
He was writing during a period of expanding literacy and growing demand for prose fiction, particularly among middle-class readers.
But most contemporary novels were explicitly moral and often focused on virtue and distress.
Exactly. Works like Richardson's Pamela celebrated female virtue and chastity. Cleland is deliberately inverting these conventions.
He was also writing from debtor's prison, which adds another layer to the novel's concern with economics.
The story goes that he wrote it to pay his debts, though that might be apocryphal, but it does reflect the economic pressures on writers.
How was the novel received when it first appeared?
It was immediately popular and immediately banned. The authorities prosecuted both Cleland and his publisher.
But it continued to circulate underground and in expurgated versions.
Right. It became one of the most widely read English novels of the 18th century, despite or because of its notoriety.
How do we read it differently today than contemporary readers would have?
We're more likely to see it as proto-feminist in its attention to female sexual agency, though that reading has its own problems.
Contemporary readers might have focused more on its challenge to religious and social authority.
and they would have been shocked by its frank treatment of sexuality in ways that modern readers might not fully appreciate.
What's its influence on later literature?
It established many conventions for erotic fiction, but it also influenced more mainstream novels in its psychological realism.
Writers like Lawrence and Miller owe something to Cleland's frank treatment of sexuality.
And feminist writers have grappled with its complex portrayal of female agency and sexuality.
As we wrap up, let's give an honest assessment. What works brilliantly in this novel?
Cleland creates a convincing female voice that articulates sexual experience in unprecedented detail. That's a remarkable achievement.
The psychological insight is genuinely sophisticated. Fanny is a complex character whose development feels believable.
And the social observation is sharp. Cleland understands how class, gender, and economics intersect in ways that feel very modern.
What doesn't work as well?
The elevated language can become ridiculous, especially in the sex scenes. Sometimes the euphemisms are more comical than erotic.
And the ending feels somewhat contrived. Fanny's return to respectability resolves too neatly.
The novel also reflects 18th-century assumptions about class and race that modern readers will find problematic.
Who should read Fanny Hill today, and what will they take from it?
Anyone interested in the history of sexuality, the development of the novel, or the intersection of literature and social change.
It's essential reading for understanding how literature has grappled with questions of female agency and desire.
And it remains a surprisingly engaging read. Fanny is a compelling narrator whose voice stays with you.
Marcus Chen, thank you for this fascinating conversation about John Cleland's controversial masterpiece.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. It's been a pleasure exploring this complex and influential novel.